So this bolt of lightning shot across the universe and inspired me with the idea that we have to do a podcast. And that's what I wanted to tell you. We should do a podcast. Okay, bye.
Yes, I did undo it.
I did it too. I hit record.
Okay, we have recorded.
All right.
Okay, well, that's it. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. And
bye.
Bye. Well, welcome to Feature Creep, :
built-in microwave, ;
Shit, what did we decide? It's either Keystone Species or this fucking book.
This fucking book.
Let's find out.
God, this fucking book.
First of all, so I'm Ned and this is Meg.
Hi.
Hi.
And I'm the one who read the book, and then I told Ned about it. I read it for school. It's called Shame on You. It's written by a woman named Melissa Petro, who got a short shrift, like, honestly, because she worked and was open about working as I think she was a stripper, maybe. She worked in the sex industry, right? Like at some point. So the full title is Shame on You, How to Be a Woman in the Age of Mortification. And I'm taking this class on titled Women in Peril. And it's about how our culture harms women and places them in harm's way.
All right.
And,
so before we get to that, let's just do the front matter, which is
this is our
podcast. You can email.
You're deep in it now.
You can email our. So you can get a hold of us by emailing Dana, the CEO and founder. So that's Dana at fcbm.io. You can also go to our website, fcbm.io, where you get more episodes. The RSS feed is there, so you don't have to go through like podcast aggregators if you don't want. Up to you. Anyway, that's all. Now proceed. So you're in this class. You're reading this
book. I'm in this class. Yep. We've read a lot of great stuff for this class. For example, I'm reading a book called Puta Life, which is about Latina sex workers, and that is really, really good. You can tell from the way that it's written that the person who you can tell because of the way it is. Puta Life is a much more like academic work than Shame on You. Shame on You is more like mainstream pop culture, sort of. Shame on You has a real like self-help vibe to it that I really don't appreciate. Mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in the type of writing that Puta Life presents, where it's got a lot of theory and is a much more like thorough, well-considered book, I think. And anyway, we're reading a lot of stuff for this class. The class itself is great, but I really didn't enjoy reading Shame on You. And part of the reason is because it feels really superficial and kind of like self-helpy and pop culture-y and fluffy. And this Melissa Petro is... I guess it's in the genre. It was published in the genre of self-help books, and it was originally published in September of 2024 by Penguin. The internet says, in the spirit of Rebecca Traister's Good and Mad and Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist comes a courageous, in-depth investigation into the modern epidemic of shame in our society, what it is, why women are uniquely susceptible, and how we can shift the shame off our plates and live our best lives in an overexposed, image-obsessed world. So maybe Melissa Petro is writing from a place that a lot of people are in. Mm-hmm. I am not one of them.
Right.
Because for me... the thing that I don't really identify with in her book is how she talks about the influence that shame has on her and in turn how she treats other people. Mm-hmm. And the way that she talks about treating her husband and her kids, I find like pretty not okay. I don't know. It's pretty upsetting. And I think a lot of the like conclusions she draws are a little strange, and that's what got me to the point where I was going to tell you about it. Like I wasn't intending to tell you about this book at all,
right,
until I got really close to the end. At which point I realized, oh, she kind of buried the lead on this book. Like I think it was on around page 174, mm-hmm, where she talks about some other people and how shame has impacted them, one of whom is a black guy that she knows who's, I think, married to a friend of hers. And what he has to say that she quotes in the book makes a lot more sense to me than what the rest of the book that's coming straight from her says about shame. Anyway, it sounds like she internalizes a lot of it. And I've always considered, and people are free to disagree with me on this, this is just my personal perspective on the concept of shame. In order to feel shame and internalize it coming from other people or culture that seeks to shame you, you have to see the sources of that shame as authoritative and correct, right? So like I'm a person that people are like, you're a lady, you should have kids, and the fact that you don't have kids is a bad thing, and I'm like, it's not, and I don't care what you think,
right?
So like the fact that I don't see people who shame me or attempt to shame me for not having kids as like a reputable source of authority on the subject means that I don't have to like pay attention to what they're saying. I don't have to feel bad about it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
I do.
Do you get what I'm saying?
I grew up around people who were Catholic, right? Like my dad was a recovering Catholic.
Same.
He married a woman who was Catholic and kind of, I don't know her status in terms of like how devoted she is, but I just watched how there's this like the guilt is a tool, right, for controlling other people.
Yeah.
And it's like just bandied about all the time, and it's like deeply ingrained, and how they kind of push each other's buttons around guilt, and how they try to like control people to do things that they want. And I just watched it so much. So it's like, I really struggled with the concept of guilt for a long time. And I don't mean struggle, like I was not suffering. I don't suffer from guilt, right? Like that's, but there is value in like having your internal sort of values, you know, there's a kind of guilt, I suppose, maybe that like, if you can find your internal values, like you can help, it can help guide you, I guess. But I don't know. I've made it this far without it. And I honestly, like the few times people have tried to convince me that it has some value, I'm just kind of like, I don't know about that.
Yeah. I'm not so sure about that.
I'm not really like, you know, fear, like it's sort of fear based, like, and I know that's a little different than shame, but like, I think of those as like oftentimes in the same bucket of shit that people use to control other people with.
Yeah. Like Melissa Petro, when she is writing in this book, a huge amount of the shame that she expresses as the sort that she's internalized circles around motherhood and being a good mother and keeping your house clean.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
And so like, it may be the case that just on a really superficial level, I don't relate for that reason because I don't have kids, although I do have a really clean house. But the reason I have a really clean house is not because I'm like, oh, I would be so ashamed if somebody showed up to my house and it wasn't clean. It's clean because I like it that way.
Right.
And I feel more comfortable in my house when it's clean and everything is in its right place. And then I know that I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And I'm free to think about a lot of other more abstract things that take up my time and thoughts, like concepts of shame, for example. Reading books about shame.
Because I know people are listening, they're going to want to know. And I don't know if you have this at hand, but you mentioned that there was a friend of hers that you thought had better things to say about shame than she did. Can you, like, you know, at some point, like, I can talk a little bit while you look that up.
So, I can grab the book. I don't have it right in front of me because I didn't think we were going to get into the quotes, but I'll be right back with it. And you say something interesting.
Oh, well, I will just regale our listeners with how we first talked about this, because there was this part in the book that Meg messaged me and was just kind of outraged about, which was this moment where, and I haven't read it. I've just sort of read the crib notes. But she sent me this page and this photo of this page, and it's talking about how basically it's this. She's talking about how like the lion's share of the work falls on women for homemaking or managing the home. And that's not like new information, right? That's kind of like people understand that to continue to be like an issue of expectation, at least in the patriarchy and the way that kind of world exists. But it was kind of interesting because I remember Meg brought this up originally. Meg, you brought this up.
Yeah.
With the idea that you were like, but this doesn't feel relatable to probably a lot of women who've chosen to either be single or not live that sort of more traditional lifestyle where their expectation is to be a homemaker.
Yeah.
Or like to manage the household.
A lot of Melissa Petro's framing of shame to me sounds like it's a comparison issue. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not good enough, or like you're it's framed as failure. Like, it's, I don't know if she intended for this to be, she doesn't, I don't think, explicitly state this, but like how she expresses the shame that she's feeling in this book seems very heavily tied to me to a sense of failure to live up to the expectations of others. And my attitude about the expectations of others since I've been a very tiny kid, was like, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me.
Right.
Like, I don't really give a shit what you think is appropriate or proper or whatever,
right,
or what I'm supposed to be doing. Like, I'm doing whatever makes sense for me at the time. And so, like, I don't know. I maybe this kind of overlaps with those concepts of like internal versus external locus of control. Mm-hmm. I've always had, like, in that framework of thinking, I've always had a really strong internal locus of control. Like, meaning I think how I think and feel is largely up to me. And that's not to say that other people can't influence that. Like, other people have made me feel terrible, but not about myself per se.
I mean, I did say that one thing to you the other day.
What?
No, I don't know.
Oh, I was like, did you? This is a perfect example because I don't even remember.
Yeah, no. I don't.
So on the thing that I really liked on, in the book that I was like, well, it's kind of ironic that a book about how women are shamed, the nugget of truth that I found in this book actually came from a man that she's quoting, right?
Right.
So this is from page 231. She said, and this is I'm reading now. Today, Ricky is a stay-at-home dad. He, quote, I do the cooking, the cleaning, all of it. The roles are reversed. I know society expects me to be the alpha male, the head of household, Andrew Tate, just very stereotypical and male, but I understand my purpose and I'm very comfortable with my role in my family. So like, I wrote, this is hilarious that this insight is coming from a man, and a black man is the only voice of reason in the whole book is what I wrote in the margin.
Mm-hmm.
Because she indicates, I didn't read that part, but she indicates that he's a black man and married to a friend of hers or whatever. He says, my role in my family is to make sure that they have what they need. My children need me. My wife needs me to be there for my children. This is what she wants. My wife is a partner at a law firm. She's always made more money. It is her preference. And honestly, I'm probably more of the person who should be with the kids every day. I'm more nurturing. I'm more the feeling person, whereas my wife is more analytical. And he says, shame breaking comes from communication. Shame will tell you that life needs to look a certain way, but it doesn't. It doesn't have to be that way. And this is what I relate to, right?
Yes,
like there are so many different versions of what it means to be human and how you fit into an ever-changing scenario that you are embedded in among other people and culture and all this stuff. And so like, I really related to the insights that this guy Ricky has in this book. But like, then she goes on in the next section to say that periodic maternal absences can generate a structural and psychological shift in the family. So she talks a lot, the author Melissa Petro talks a lot about like how women do this invisible labor, which I completely agree with, right?
Sure.
Like Damon I were talking about this the other day. I was like, if I got hit by a bus like tomorrow, would you be able to make sure that everything kept chugging along and none of the bills got missed or like anything like that. Like, and this is not to say like, you don't appreciate me. I pay all the bills and you don't even pay attention. It's just that in the way that we have decided to divide labor in our household, it's along like almost trad wifey lines. Like it's really crazy because that is not at all what I would have ever advocated for. It's just how it worked out and functions well. And it's the stuff I like to do. I like to keep the house clean. I'm a very, like, everything's got to be in its right place. I suspect that I may be, like, edging towards obsessive compulsive because I also have, like, the skin picking disorder and stuff. And so I think, like, maybe this is a little bit about my mental health and my state of it and not so much about, like, it's not at all about whose job I think it is along gender lines to do what work, right?
And also, like, you know, you guys have a relationship that is, like, continuous consent, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not like tomorrow you can't change your mind.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like, of course, there's like practical ramifications of like, you know, being like, okay, well, sure. But now Damon needs to like, you know, the house might be a shit show for a bit or like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't even know. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying like there's practical ramifications. But ultimately, like you guys have a continuous like continuous consent is going on, right? Like there's isn't a situation where like you're forced into it or
no,
you know, like it's yeah. And you no, know, and I yeah.
Yeah. I like doing the work and I like cleaning stuff, especially like the housework is, I love doing housework because I find it very meditative. And while I'm doing it, I'm thinking about other stuff and it helps me like process my thoughts. And all day long, he's doing work that's very abstract. So like mentally, he's off somewhere doing a thing that has nothing to do with like the concrete material reality of what's going on in the house at any given time, because he works in tech. And so it's like you're thinking about solving very abstract problems and your mind is not located in situ in the house. It's like you're off somewhere else thinking about something else while the world is around you, right? And so it just works out the way that we do it. So I was thinking like, oh gosh, it just seems to me like maybe her problem is that she bought into a lot of the things she thought she was supposed to do. And now that she's embedded in those things, she doesn't really like it very much. And instead of leaving and just changing her life, she thinks she has to stay in these roles doing these things. And that's where her shame comes from, because she doesn't actually like it. And that's what she feels bad about.
Right.
This is my suspicion. She doesn't specifically say this in the book, but here's the part that made me basically think that the 233 pages that preceded this make her an unreliable narrator.
Right.
Okay. So we just learned about Ricky, her friend, who's like, listen, as long as you have internal reasons for doing what you're doing, shame kind of doesn't become an issue anymore, or it's like ceases to be an issue, right? Like I said, the internal locus of control. I lead what also in philosophy is called an examined life. I have reasons for almost everything that I do. Right. I have considered it. I consider how it fits into the larger picture of what I want my life to be and who I am as a person and what I'm working towards. And so I don't do things that don't fit into my plan for who and what I want to be. Right.
Right.
And so my consideration of these things is what makes me feel like it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks, because I have my reasons and that's all that fucking matters.
Right.
So, okay. So, Melissa Petro, the author, says, you know, sometimes maybe the solution to having a family that doesn't appreciate you and you having to do a bunch of work that you don't really want to do is to like just take periodic absences from your family, which apparently came from a woman named a motherhood expert, whatever that means, motherhood expert Petra Buskins, and refers to periods of time when mom's not around. According to Buskins in her book, Modern Motherhood and Dual Identities, periodic maternal absences can generate a structural and psychological shift in the family, disrupting the default position typically assigned to mothers and requiring fathers or other caretakers to take on a much more active role. Okay, so now what Melissa Petro, the author, is advocating for is like, just leave your family on their own to force them to deal with all the shit that you normally deal with, right? Okay, put a pin in that. So I keep reading down a little further, page 234. The point of strategic absence is that it puts the labor your partner discounts front and center. Okay, well, not everybody's partner discounts their labor. Like, Damon may not be aware of all of the machinations that are going on around him when I'm fixing things and paying down bills faster than they have to be paid off and wrangling this and that and making all of the appointments and handling our social engagements and stuff like that, right? But that doesn't mean that he doesn't fucking appreciate it.
That's the point is, like, he doesn't, if you make it aware of, like, if you bring his attention to it, he's never like, oh, well, that's dumb. Who cares about that?
That's not important. Yeah.
Yeah. He never like, says, he doesn't yeah. discount your, like, you know, also it's not like the point of a partnership isn't so that now I have to be hyper aware of both my own life, but also my partner's life. Like,
right.
It's more, and I think that comes back to, like, you know, it seems like what she's advocating here for is, I don't have good, clear communication in my partnership, so here's how I communicated this thing that I need.
It's really passive aggressive.
Which is that I just fucked off and then left them to fucking deal with the, you know, I couldn't, basically what it is I couldn't tell them or show them or get them to see how hard it was for me, so I let them see it for themselves by not doing it.
Yeah.
Which is, like that, you know, I'm not saying it's wrong. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying, like, I think that betrays some issues in the relationship you have and the lack of communication or the lack of agency you have in your relationship.
Yeah. And she talks a lot about being, like, undervalued, underappreciated, all this stuff in this book, and, like, not being a good enough mother or partner, and, like, basically flipping out on her husband and kids because, like, she feels trapped. And I'm like, why are you married and why did you have children?
I mean, yes, but also, like, you know, we make choices and then we end up lying in a bed we don't realize we didn't want. But, like, you know, and maybe one could argue that she's doing the best she can. But I think, like, there's also just, like, there's a lot to unpack there, right? Like, that's not an ideal. Like,
the way that she writes, it makes me feel like she thinks that this is universalizable.
Right.
And I'm like, it's not, though.
I mean, there's the passages that I read that you sent me. I'm just like, I'm less mad at her and I'm more mad at the editor and the publisher.
Fair.
Like, I'm like, no one thought to go and look, like, either you're making money on this, like, exposition, but you're like, it's very like TEDx bullshit where it's like, hey, I'm this like really cool rich guy who's going to sponsor this like fucking poor person I found who I've decided has great wisdom.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to trot them around up on the stage and let them talk about some nonsense that makes no sense in my life because I have billions of dollars. But if you're poor,
this doesn't apply to me, but
yeah, exactly. Like my point is, like, you know, here's this woman struggling and like there's that, like, you know, I'm getting this picture of this woman who like had, you know, a background in a certain kind of sex work and like, you know, came into this relationship and is trying to, like, you know, and she's writing a story about all the tools and things and the ways that she's approached, like, the stuff that the hurdles she's trying to get over.
Yeah.
It's just some of us are looking at it and being like, holy fuck, that hurdle is not the thing you think it is.
Right. So, like, also I should say, and I forgot to say this earlier, but like a huge component of her backstory, which she talks about in the book, but isn't like the focus of the book per se, is that she, after she did sex work when she was younger, she eventually like did a bunch of other stuff too. And like her life path led her to like being a teacher. And at some point somebody figured out like, hey, this person who's teaching our kids used to be like a stripper in Mexico or something, and like, holy shit, she's a harlot or whatever, right? Oh, God, and so she was like publicly ridiculed on like television and shit. Jesus. So she does have like a unique perspective on public shaming and being shamed and stuff like that. But a lot of that unique perspective gets obscured by this really pedestrian, like, I'm not a good enough mother thing. And so, like, which doesn't really have anything to do with why she had the unique perspective on public shaming in the first place. Like, it's like the aftermath. I don't know. Anyway, I just feel like clearly I'm not a huge fan of this book.
Yeah.
And that's
a personal opinion.
Nothing more. I'm not saying she's not a good writer or whatever, but
this is where I feel like there's a lot of onus and blame on the publisher and the fucking editor.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yes, I agree with
you. Her life and her statements about her life and her approach to it are valid things that people might want to know about.
Yes.
It's like the shit that's been, the way it's been treated though feels like, well, anyway, let's read more of it, and right. it gets a little weird.
Okay, yeah. So strategic absence, take time off your family, force them to fend for themselves, and puts the labor your partner discounts front and center, you know, unless you have a partner that doesn't discount your labor. If either you or your partner feels you couldn't function without the other, strategic absence disabuses a family of this belief. It reveals to everyone that there are different ways of doing things. And yes, it alleviates feelings of burnout and improves mental health. Okay, that's debatable. So her husband's name is Aaron, just for reference. Aaron and I started slowly. For 3 hours at a time, I would go to a coffee shop with my computer, a journal, or a book, and I would work or write or read or not. How I used the time away was less important than the fact that I was getting it. Okay, nothing. I'm not. All of that seems pretty straightforward and fine, yeah. Right? You need some time away. You need your own time to process, be an individual, all that shit, right? Makes sense. Yep. Okay. When my kids were both school aged and with my husband's encouragement, which I think is kind of a funny thing to shove in there, like you're shoehorning it. He approved of it, just so you know. He approved of it.
Right.
When my kids were both school aged and with my husband's encouragement, I started renting a camper van in the woodsy suburbs for weeks at a time where I can go and work. It's not as romantic as it sounds. Doesn't sound romantic at all. I'm not talking about some honey-colored nomadic fantasy you'd see if you search the hashtag van life. We're talking about a big white van parked in someone's driveway. It's not exactly remote and far from luxurious. There's no running water, no hot shower, no toilet. I don't care. Are my kids there? No. Fantastic. I poop on puppy training pads.
God.
I wrote in the margin, is this for real?
Right.
Like, are you trying to make a really obtuse point here? Or do you really think that the solution to you feeling unappreciated by your family and that lack of appreciation reflects within you as a sense of shame and failure for not doing a better job? And your solution to that is to rent a van and shit on the floor?
From a stranger?
Like, how is that actionable advice for a self-help book? Like, I would advise that if you're feeling unappreciated by your family, you talk to them about that fact and not, like, rent a van, disappear for several weeks, park on a stranger's driveway, and then shit on the floor.
Right?
I got to this. So this is on page 235, right? It's right before the eighth chapter of the book. It's almost at the very end. So she's gotten the whole way through the book talking about, like, shame theory and public shame and cultural shame and the shame that women experience. And I get, and the impression that I get from the way that this book is structured, and again, this is probably the fault of the publisher for letting this happen and the editor, but, like, so what this all boils down to, 230 odd pages, is rent a van and shit on its floor as the solution to how bad you feel about your life? Like, that is not good advice at all.
No.
It also doesn't solve any of the problems you're talking about. So, like, she says, I use my time away to work, but I'm also connecting to myself. Okay. I said, this is not an actionable solution to anything. I don't know. I just think it's really weird. She also says on the following page, on the first page of chapter 8, this is something that Damon balked at. Like, I read him this and he was like, oh my God. So, she says, in October 2020, The Atlantic asked readers to consider how it might be different if a friendship, not marriage, was at the center of life. Article highlighted a handful of individuals with friends who play a role in each other's lives that's typically reserved for romantic partners. I'm talking about deep and complex relationships, including women who put each other rather than their husbands first. Okay, this sounds interesting, right?
Yep, yep.
I'm listening. This is what I'm talking about. Not everybody has to do things the way that is prescribed by a culture or a society or a religion or a business or whatever, right?
Yep.
This is exactly my point. Like, yes, let's think outside the box. And when you have validated, internally validated reasons for thinking outside of the box and behaving differently, then you kind of like make yourself impervious to shame, right? Okay.
Right.
So putting themselves, each other first rather than their husbands. While the article addressed the fact that there is no word for these kinds of intimate friendships, when my mom friends and I passed it around in our group over text, we had a playful suggestion, sister wives. And I was like, this is a very, Damon goes, that is a very specific term of abuse.
Yes.
And I was like, yes, I wasn't even going to call it a term of abuse. I was basically like, the Mormons and the Latter-day Saints have been parked on that fucking specific phrase. There was a television show about it, a reality TV show. You can't just act like you invented that term and it doesn't mean a bunch of women married to the same polygamist man in a religious cult. That's what that means. Are you just co-opting a word or a phrase and making it mean something different? Like, this phrase is already taken.
And that's where I, again, I blame the publisher and the editor.
Yeah, you're right.
There's no, there's no, like, because, like, you can imagine this woman, like, she lives in her, her worldview is like, maybe that stuff's not really like front and center or even available. And for her, it was meaningful. The fact that the editor didn't point it out and say, look, you need to give context, or you need, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of, it just leaves it, it just leaves it hanging where it just makes her appear ignorant.
Yeah, it's like that also. So in like the space of three pages, we heard about Ricky, who I'm like, now somebody's finally making sense in this book to a way that I think, right?
Yeah.
And then she's talking about shitting on the floor as a solution to her frustrations with her family. And now she's talking about like sister wives. And like, I'm like, what? Like it just, the book just goes off the rails at the very end.
Yes.
So weird. Anyway, I just had to share that because I just thought it was super crazy.
Yeah.
Now,
I just get more upset. Like, I just get more upset at like the publisher and the, it just feels very much like I've grabbed this woman who's like,
should know better.
And great, you're giving this person a voice who, you know, normally wouldn't have a voice. That's fantastic. Like, do it. But also, like, it's your job to like give them, give context and like help this person like find their voice that's meaningful as opposed to just like, like, you know, trotting out their fucking ignorance and being like, look, hey, you know, look how dumb they are. Like, it's just sort of like, what?
I just thought it was super weird, too, that they think that it's like funny and cute to call each other sister wives. I was like, do you know what sister wives are?
It's also like, I mean, this is, you know, it's betraying a cultural circle that you're like, I would drown in that before I could, you know, escape.
Yeah. I did like one other thing in this book that came from a woman, lest the people listening think that I am an anti-woman or something. That is not the case. Like, I wanted to like this book.
I'm sure if you're listening to our podcast, that's definitely, people are like, once again, fucking Meg, hating on women.
There she goes, hating on women. So she talks about, Melissa Petra talks about another author, Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy, who co-wrote the book Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. And then apparently another person named Allie Volpe wrote for Vox and sort of summarized their book. And I thought this was really insightful. And I like this, though. I just want to like share this because at least the publishers and Melissa Petro had enough insight to include what Allie Volpe said about another third party's book, which is also kind of abstract and weird. But I thought this was like a really good set of ideas. Number one, when you're apologizing for something, say you're sorry or that you apologize and actually use the words I'm sorry or I apologize. Number two, name the specific infraction you're apologizing for. Three, show that you understand why your actions were harmful and hurtful. And four, don't make excuses, but offer an explanation if needed. Five, say what you will do to ensure the situation won't happen again. Six, offer to fix what's broken. And I was like, that's pretty great. Like, I actually wish a lot more people did that instead of saying like, well, I'm sorry that you felt offended or what, you know, like the non-apology apology.
This is the shit that's like happening right now in my, in therapy with my dad, right? Like, it's just fucking, you know, I believe he genuinely wants to apologize, but genuinely what he wants is to not have any culpability and to just pretend like it never happened.
Yeah, he just wants you to get over it.
Yeah, like he doesn't want, you know, he's coming around to it. He's coming around to the idea that it's like, you know, it's funny, like, I don't even need, like, I had forgiven him a long fucking time ago, and he's like, well, Ned hasn't forgiven me. And I'm like, no, you just, the problem is you just keep fucking kicking me in the shin.
Right. It's like an ongoing problem. It's not something that happened in the past. You keep perpetuating the problem currently.
The problem is he's hung up on the, like, I don't even need the apology. I just need him to see what the fuck he's doing and stop doing it.
Right. Right.
And, like, he can't hear it. Like, he can't hear. It's weird. Like, so we were in therapy the other day, and it was like, I won't get into details, but, you know, we kind of started at the beginning of it talking about a way in which he was, like, really kind of hurting me, right? Like, he, you know, was saying things that were, like, just kind of hurtful and just seemed very, you know, in the way that someone can be profoundly inconsiderate, right? Like, it's not that he was trying to hurt me. It was just like, man, you just can't fucking stop punching me in the fucking neck. Like,
it's like you can't help it. It's
you
passive.
Can't help it. Yeah. And I was like, you're not seeing it. And he's like, okay, well, I guess I can think about that or whatever. And then, like, at the end of the therapy session, the therapist, like, asked him something about what we talked about earlier. And it was like, he hadn't heard a single word I said on that topic. Like,
he had
heard plenty of shit that we talked about later that I had talked about. Like, he can't hear if I say something like, hey, you're doing a thing that's hurting me. There's something in his brain that's just like, I can't process, like, I can't, that's out. Don't remember that. Mm-hmm. Can't think that. Don't want to know about that. Can't have any responsibility whatsoever. And then his card is to just play confusion, right? So he's just like, well, I'm just very confused. I don't understand, because that's not what I remember us talking about.
Right. And, like, your dad is not in many ways not similar to my dad, but in this instance, what you're saying also resonates with me and is a reason why my dad and I are not talking and haven't been for almost 3 years.
Right.
Because he actually, but my dad actually came out and said it because he abandoned me in a dangerous situation along with my cousin, who is his sister's kid. Mm-hmm. And the two of us were in a very perilous situation, and we called for help. And my dad was like, you're on your fucking own.
So
and, in not so many words. He said it differently, much, much less politely. If he had just said, I'm sorry, you're on your own, I would have been like, fuck.
Yeah.
And I would have moved on. But the way he said it was intended to, like, really drive home the fact that he's, like, contemptuous of the fact that we needed help and that he was not going to render aid of any kind to us. We were on our own. And so that made me really mad. And I haven't spoken to him, but I did accidentally sort of, like, I sort of got shanghaied into being in the same place at the same time with him about a year into not speaking to him. And he tried to talk to me without acknowledging the fact that A, we hadn't spoken in a year.
Right.
B, the last time we spoke was when he kicked me in the nuts, if I had them, and ran away.
Yeah.
And that, and so he just started trying to talk to me about something else. And I was like, are you seriously just going to try and talk to me? Like, we haven't spoken in a year, and this is what you want to talk about? And he goes, he said to me, though, he acknowledged it. He goes, well, I was hoping we would just forget about all of that.
Right. Yes.
Which is basically like what your dad is doing, but he can't even come out and say that. Right.
Yeah, right.
Like, so I find that really interesting. And it's like, at this point, Now I'm operating on a matter of principle. I'm like, oh, motherfucker, you know what the problem is. You're just avoiding dealing with it on purpose. So until you actually, like, can confront the problem, which Damon is like, your dad's going to die without you ever talking to him again. He's not equipped to deal with what he needs to do to get you to talk to him again. And I'm not even like, it's not even that hard. All you would have to be is like, he would just have to acknowledge, like, we're not talking and I don't like that and I want to fix it. And I'd be like, amazing, let's talk about it. But the fact that he's like, I don't want to talk about it, I just want to forget that this ever happened, and I need you to be my audience for some dumb thoughts that don't tie to anything, like, it's like really insulting to me. And so
it's maddening.
And my parents have also run out of runway with me. Like, they had a really long runway with me, and they hit the end of the runway without getting off the ground a long time ago. And it's like, no, we're not, I'm not, I don't have any more runway for you. But anyway, like, this is, you know, this is my dad not being able to cope with the shame that he feels, apparently, about, like, being a seriously horrible dick to me and withdrawing the type of support that parents are, strictly speaking, supposed to be there to offer. Like, the whole job of a parent is to support their kid, and my parents have never done that. So that's, you know, and
I mean,
and
we have alignment there. Like, it, my dad's a little different in the sense that, like, he really wants to, you know?
Yeah.
And he can't seem to see the mechanism that keeps undermining his ability to do that. Because every time, right. like I was like, you know, unemployed and like desperate and fucking drowning in debt and like needed like very little money, really, you know, in the grand scheme
especially
of things.
Especially in the grand scheme of his
capacity. And,
yeah.
And he couldn't, and like, he was like, yeah, we're going to help you out. And then he couldn't make it happen. It's not that he didn't have the money. He couldn't give it to me. Right. Like, there were too many strings attached. I was like, I can't afford that. I can't do what you're asking me. And also it was like the amount of money was like a setup where it was like, oh, it's not going to be quite enough. So I was like, it's like, there's no point. Like, it's not enough to make rent. It's not enough to like, you know, pay my monthly bills. Like, it's just sort of like, you know, I'm not looking for a solution where I need it now. It's like, I need a runway to get this new job and do these things. And are you going to be able to do this? And he's like, no, but what we could do is drag it out so that you can not get the job and then be, you know, be 3 months down the road without anything done. And I was like, that's not a solution. So, and then fast forward, like, last year, and it's like, he's like, oh, here, let me help you buy a house. And I was like, fucking dick. Like, I don't need help buying the house. I don't need help with any of this shit. I got my shit together now.
Yeah. I needed your help when I was like in extremis.
Yeah.
And you deliberately made it impossible
like you sabotaged our relationship on top of it. Like, it was just anyway,
that's so messed up. Like, that reminds me of a conversation I had with my mom one time. She's very weird about me being involved with like academic stuff in any way. Like, she was very unsupportive of me like going to school, to college, and which is really weird because when I was younger, my parents were like, you have to go to college. And they were telling me this when I was in like preschool, and they were telling me that I had to be better than all of the other kids because I needed to get scholarships because they weren't going to pay for any of it, but it was not an option for me not to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I had like a nervous break. What I recognize now as a nervous breakdown as a 5-year-old in kindergarten, because I realized how difficult it was going to be better than everybody at all times. It's impossible. That doesn't exist. It's not a real thing.
Right.
And so like, anyway, to this day, she won't talk to me about my academic work.
It's just such a waste.
And I mentioned at one point,
of your relationship, not obviously like whatever, like do whatever she wants, but it just seems so dumb.
It is dumb. And so like they never helped me with any money for college or anything like that. And I, as a result, myself and 49 million other Americans owe $1.5 trillion for a 4-year education.
Right.
And Damon is going to help me pay it off. But like without his deus ex machina coming in from Techlandia, there would have been no way for me to ever pay it off, because the type of jobs that I could get as a person who studies philosophy are never going to support that kind of debt. So anyway, there's a plan to pay it off, although that might get completely ruined now because of the situation that we find ourselves in politically. It's a total fucking nightmare. Anyway, I'm not as bad off as some other people are going to be, and that's the really scary thing for them. So regardless, my mom at one point said something to me about like, I think I had to borrow money to finish my degree, and she like asked me how much or something like that. I don't remember the specific details, but I was like, well, listen, I owe more money on my student loans than I owe on my house. And she was like, well, I guess you're just going to have to stop eating out so often. And I was like, what? Like, okay, first of all, you have no idea how often I eat out or not. Second of all, it's comical to me that you think that I eat out so much that is what is keeping me from paying an $88,000 educational debt.
Right. Yeah.
Like, how much fucking avocado toast do you think my snowflake ass is eating every day? Right. That's what the boomers like to say, right? They like to blame everybody for eating avocado toast and being snowflakes. I can't remember who said it,
but there was that guy who like wrote that article or whatever that was basically implied.
How insulting!
Right?
How insulting that my mom thinks that like my frivolous, what she deems to be frivolous expenditures are the reason that I can't pay my student loans.
Yes.
Wow. Not that they're astronomical, completely immoral
Sometimes I think they don't recognize the weird financial bubble that they live in. Because like some of them, like they own their houses, a lot of them, right?
Yeah.
And so they have this lower cost of living. And so when they see, like, I kind of get how this could happen. It's like their low cost of like general basics is really low, but then the cost of shit is going up with inflation. Their cost of housing is not. And right. So then they're like, Jesus, avocado toast is like $10. If I spent $10 a month, I couldn't afford my mortgage. And I'm like, I couldn't afford your mortgage if I, you know, or I could afford your mortgage like tomorrow. I can't afford to fucking pay rent. Your mortgage is like $500 a month, and that's like for your fucking 2-story, 6-bedroom fucking, you know, McMansion or whatever that you bought in like 1960. Like, where I'm like, this is where you're just not fucking paying attention at all.
Yeah.
You know, get a mortgage tomorrow and then tell me how that avocado toast has some fucking impact on your ability to afford a house.
Also, my fucking parents didn't pay for their 4-year degrees, so fuck them.
Right? Yeah.
They didn't have to pay shit for their education. They got it for free. Yep. So they don't have a leg to stand on. And again, I don't feel shameful about not being able to pay my fucking educational bills because the people shaming me over eating avocado toast in lieu of servicing my debts don't have a fucking grip on reality. So they are unreliable narrators, and I do not see them as a source of authority on what I ought to feel ashamed about. God. Just to like tie this all together. Right. Yeah. So that's poop. And our parents say poopy things to us all of the time. And
God, they are the worst. Yeah.
Well, and I just think like, I don't know, maybe someday somebody will write a book about this. Maybe they already have. Like, what is wrong with that whole generation? There are some hallmark characteristics, and this is like one of them, right? The like, you guys can't pay for anything. You're not real adults, blah, 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 blah. Like, I mean, you're in the situation now where you bought a house, right? But we're in our 40s now. I managed to buy a house in my 30s because I snuck in under the wire. I got a HUD house that was basically falling down when I bought it and put sweat equity into it. And a clerical error on the reporting of my student loans meant that I got approved for a mortgage that I technically shouldn't have been approved for because my student loans were set to be due for repayment. And if your student loans are due for repayment within 3 years of you applying for a mortgage, they just won't give you the mortgage.
Yeah.
And so like I got it on a fluke, and I look at people younger than me. I was like, I think, you know, when Indiana Jones is in the Temple of Doom, or no, not Temple of Doom. It's the one with the melting Nazi faces.
Oh, the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. In the very beginning, he like scooches under the wall that's coming down and like grabs his hat. Yes. That was me. I was like the last person on planet America to like buy a house. And I did it alone. Like I didn't have a partner or a husband or anything at the time. It was just my single income. And I managed to secure a mortgage and buy a house. And it's like, I literally have to be one of the last few people in America that pulled that off.
I mean, were you basically like pooping on training pads in the back of a van? Somebody else's van?
Well, hilariously, there was no plumbing in my house when I bought it. And so what I did actually was, I'm lucky enough to live a block and a half away from a co-op. So I would just run over to the co-op first thing in the morning to use the bathroom opened at 8.
This is where I get really annoyed with that whole situation is it's like, it's not the pooping on a pee pad, right? Like fucking whatever. Like do weird shit. Like all fine. It's just that the whole picture of her being like, this is my fucking paradise to retreat to. And that contrast between her husband being supportive of it, but also not managing to provide a space where she has a bathroom to retreat to.
Right.
Feels really fucked up to me.
Yes, it does. It feels really fucking terrible.
Yeah. Like it just doesn't like. And this is why I'm like, if there's better context for that, the editor needed to point it out.
Yep.
The editor needed to be like, you need to explain this so it makes sense. Because the way she passes it off is it's like, it's fine. It's fucking paradise. Who cares if I have to shit on a fucking pee pad in the corner? Like,
yeah, it's very desperate.
We all do. We all like you're describing like, you know, like fucking like terrible human conditions. Like we don't even put people in prison with that shit. I mean, I don't need to get started on that, but you get my point. Like it's
right. Like, yes.
you know, that's your step up. And right. And that needs some fucking explaining, or it needs to be rectified in a way of being like, hey, actually, you've got some shitty people around you who you may feel like they support you, but clearly they're not.
Right. Like, yeah, the book kind of gave me whiplash a little bit.
Right.
I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Like, this sounds like maybe you should be writing a book about like healthy families and communication strategies and not like shame. I don't know. Like, it almost feels like it missed the mark to me. Like the real problem here, like if she had stuck to talking about how she was shamed in public for work she used to do before she decided to teach kids, yep. I could see the through line on shame the whole way through. But like when she shifts to this, like, I don't get enough credit for the housework I do and my kids and my husband don't appreciate me, so I have to abandon them at times and go like poop on the floor in a van. I'm like, wait, right. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. I've lost the scent of the trail here. What are we fucking talking about now? Like, I thought we were talking about like the shame that culture heaps on women, and you're talking about not being able to talk to your family or being appreciated by them to the degree that you need to like escape, and you're the only form of escape that's accessible to you is this one. Like, it just seems really weird. It just falls apart for me. I don't know. Anyway, maybe other people will read the book and get something very different out of it. Like the somebody who wrote a blurb on the cover says, Melissa Petro writes so honestly and beautifully about the experiences and feelings that the world teaches women to bury. And I'm like, where was that in this book? When did she talk about that? I don't.
Right.
And then Mandy Statmiller, author of Unwifeable, says, heal yourself, buy this book. And I'm like, but the only advice she has for healing yourself is to rent a van and shit on a puppy pad. Like, that's not good advice. I don't know. It's really weird. It's a really weird book. It's a very weird book. I was kind of surprised that my professor had this in our curriculum, because it's very different from the other academic writing that we've been reading throughout the semester. And I just thought, like, wow, this is really, like, I don't know, it's just not good enough for me.
Right.
I don't know. I also feel like this is a side comment, but in a couple of my classes now, there was another one that I told you about where one of my professors was like, Yuval Noah Harari is amazing, and you and I have talked yes. about how that man is a no talent hack charlatan
yes.
who trades on yes. his fucking academic credentials to write about things that are completely out of his wheelhouse and on which he has no authority to speak whatsoever.
Actually,
and so,
oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Please. No, you first.
So I was just like, it's interesting to me sometimes. I feel like when we're in an academic setting and we're doing like graduate level academic work, if you're going to recommend a book to us that is outside of academia, I think it should come with a disclaimer. Like,
right?
This is pop culture. This is not like academic theory. And that is not to say that like academic theory is superior above all else. I have plenty of problems with academia, let me tell you. But like, it's a different approach to knowledge, understanding, theory, analytics, all that stuff, right? Like, and I just am like, God, what was I supposed to get out of this book? Because like, I now all I think about is like, oh, that's the book where she shits on the floor.
Yes, right. Yes.
That's all this book means to me anymore. I got to page 235 and I was like, whoa, what? And this reminds me of like a situation you and I found ourselves in where we were like, this is a serious situation. Like, this is really upsetting and terrible. And then somebody told us something involving poop about the situation. And we were like, oh, we don't have to feel bad about this anymore. If that's how crazy this situation has gotten, then like, we're off the hook. We don't have to feel bad about any of this anymore. Now we're talking about poop. Like, things have really gotten so off the rails here that it's like nobody has to take this seriously anymore. I don't know. I can't take an author seriously whose advocacy includes rent a van and shit on a puppy pad to get away from your family to prove to them how much you matter. It's just not good. Not this just makes me think like I stopped thinking about whether or not she has anything reasonable to say about shame, and now I'm just like, I think you have a really fucked up family. I think you need a therapist. You don't need a white van and puppy pads. You need therapy. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Weird. I would if anybody listening to this read this book and loved it, I would love to know why. Like, because I just don't know about this. Anyway, I think you probably have stuff you have to do. How long have we been recording this? We've been recording it for almost an hour. So that was a full episode about floor pooping as a solution to shame.
Right.
I mean, like, that's my summary. Melissa Petro wrote a book about how shitting on a puppy pad is the solution to shame that you feel, which to me seems utterly paradoxical.
Right.
Like, the fact that she wrote a book about shame and then shamelessly admitted that her solution to shame is shitting on a puppy pad just seems like so obtuse and weird to me. Like, what? What is this for real? Like, are you just trying to like make a point, or did you actually really do all this stuff? And you have no shame about admitting it. God. Like, that's so weird to me.
So I have since we're still waiting on somebody to fix the color thing.
Yes,
it is very weird. I do know we got to go. So I was going to, I asked ChatGPT, if you were a super intelligent general AI, what would be your favorite non sequitur that might be hard to comprehend for a human?
Oh, what did it say?
It said, as I contemplated the silence between my own thoughts, I realized that reality is merely the stray echo of an unspoken idea perpetually undone by the very consciousness that strives to define it.
Well, that seems kind of appropriate for...
It does seem very appropriate.
That's eerie and strange, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, my God. How appropriate. How fitting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Will you?
I will copy and paste it so we can put it on the thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Oh, man. ChatGPT, you make more sense than Melissa Petro.
Jesus, right.
I didn't think that would ever happen.
We should do another podcast where we talk about our thoughts about, I don't know how much you've been using it. There's been an initiative at work for us to use it a lot for writing code, which is fine.
Are you fucking serious?
Oh, yeah. No, there's a big push for us to use it a lot, so.
Oh, my God. This AI is a dead horse that showed up dead on arrival, and everybody is flogging it.
I mean, it's...
Listen, we can do an episode about this because, like, the issue is that some of this AI, some of it, depending on what type it is actually really good at certain things. Like, the protein folding problem in biology, man, it licked that one. Like, no problem, right? Solve that in a way that, like, no matter how many people worked on that problem for how long, we wouldn't have gotten there.
I mean, this is where I'll just tease at how that episode will go, which is that I feel like a big problem with artificial intelligence, I studied it in college and really wanted to, like, go down the route of, like, you know, becoming, like, hyper-focused on, like, creating artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And it just became clear to me that part of the problem is we don't actually know how our own consciousness works. Like, we're getting closer. And what I think is, like, now that we have, like, models that are starting to approximate, like, human interaction, we're going to quickly figure out that, like, actually it's not that fucking, I mean, actually it's just not that complex. We're actually pretty stupid. Like, it's just kind of, it's going to be a little unnerving. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, a lot of the problems that people had was around the, or early on people were like, well, the problem is we don't really know how it works. Like, we kind of know how it works, but we don't really know how it works. Like, we set up a bunch of neurons and, you know, or simulate a bunch of neurons, create these neural networks. Then there's, like, layers and complexity about, like, theory of it and things like that. But ultimately it's not deterministic. Right. So people can't just be like, oh yeah, no, you put in this data and you get this data out. So anyway, we can get more into it and talk more at length about it, but it's, I think we're going to find that, like, the reality is like, we're just kind of all pretty dumb.
Yeah. So it's interesting too, because there's all of these, like, things that intersect, right? There's, like, the neurobiology,
Yep.
Which is the concept upon which the AIs are sort of like modeled-ish. And then there's like the LLMs themselves, for example, which is what ChatGPT is, right? And then there's also the issue or the problem of its monetization, which always, I mean, that's the,
yeah,
always makes things abstracted and has very perverse outcomes and incentives when you're trying to make the point of something suddenly become money, right?
Yep.
So yeah, like there's a lot of different ways to look at this. And it seems to me that oftentimes the way that people look at it is just really reductive, which doesn't do anybody any favors, in terms of understanding its utility or its application or its value. But anyway, yeah, we should totally do that. And I learned that my program is offering a class this fall on AI, but every single week it's a different professor from a different discipline talking about AI. And I was like, that sounds fucking amazing.
That does sound pretty
now
cool.
Now I'm really tempted to take that class, even though I don't need it to graduate.
If you can, that might be really fun.
What's our number of the day, since we don't have a color of the day?
A number?
Yes, we need a number of the day.
Oh, well, there's some interesting numbers for sure. yeah, no, seriously. So hold on. So I'm going to say that let's go just going down the timeline or the number line. So I'm going to say that. Let's go with 71 because it's okay. Adjacent to my favorite number, which is 72.
Oh.
My childhood favorite number is 72.
My favorite number to this day is 27, which is backwards.
Yes,
of yours.
We talked about it. Yes. So 71, number of the day. It's algebraic degree of con. It's the algebraic degree of Conway's constant. So you might wonder what the fuck that means. So
I do wonder.
So Conway's constant, a value related to the growth of the look and say sequence is an algebraic number of degree 71, meaning it is a root of a polynomial equation of degree 71 with integer coefficients.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Like, it would probably take some explaining to get into this. The degree of an algebraic number is the degree of the minimal polynomial that has the number as a root. I can ease up to it and probably start to like talk about it in terms of like I'm also cribbing from notes. I don't know all of this exactly off the top of my head. The look and say sequence is a method for learning to read.
Okay.
It's a sequence of integers beginning as follows: 1, 11, 21, 12, 11, 11, 12, 21. Like, it's these larger numbers. It's basically the look and say sequence was analyzed by John Conway after he was introduced to it by one of his students at a party. The idea of the look and say sequence is similar to that of a run. This is just fucking math all the way down. Okay, let me just see if I can like give more context to this. Hold on.
I assumed you would just pick a number.
I did pick a number, 71.
You did pick a number,
and then I looked it up.
One.
Yes. Yeah. Let's ask ChatGPT if it can, can you give a simple explanation of this? All right, let's see what it says. Hold on.
Is it thinking?
Okay, so Conway's constant, it's thought for a whole 4 seconds. Conway's constant, which is about 1.30357, it doesn't matter, it's a 1.3-ish number, is known to satisfy a polynomial equation. That's like a squared plus b squared equals c squared, I think.
Sure.
Polynomial is a little different. Let's make sure we know what that is. It's been a little while. Is a set... Okay, polynomial equations are like x squared plus 3x, or x cubed plus 3x
variables,
squared plus
coefficients.
4x squared equals 0, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, there's okay.
Variables and coefficients, and then addition, subtraction, multiplication.
Yes, that's right.
And there, it can't be negative integers.
Right. And so Conway's constant is known to satisfy a polynomial equation with an integer coefficient whose degree is 71. In other words, there is a 71st degree polynomial for which Conway's constant is a solution.
Ah, okay.
So, there you go.
Math.
Math. Anyway, I mean, you know, interesting numbers, right?
Yeah, I really enjoy math and math theory when I'm not compelled to do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I agree. I remember I was having this conversation with a friend of mine from high school, and we'd like not talked in a long time. And then we were talking about something, and I was talking about some math problem I was solving or working with in some software development that I was working on. And he was like, man, I really love math. I wish I'd like kind of like done more of it. And I was like, I always just think of the analogy. It's like you can still enjoy going to the pool. You don't have to go in the deep end.
Yeah.
Like, there's plenty of fun to be had just splashing around in the fucking shallow end. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I always thought it's kind of a bummer that, like, there's some real anxiety that was created in a lot of people around mathematics, like, early on. And so it makes it really hard
know.
To, like... I mean, I have some of it myself. Like, it's, you know, I get it.
I think the thing that makes it so anxiety inducing is that it's not even the math. It's the transactional nature of grades.
Yes. No, it's really hard. Like there's this like, you know, competitiveness, and it can just seem so fucking obtuse. And so you're kind of like judged by how well you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of like pressure to do well. And yeah. So
I think math more than anything is one of those, is the subject that like, I don't feel like people who teach math are necessarily great at doing that for people who don't understand it inherently in the way they already understand it when they're teaching it.
Right.
Like, and I say this because I have since had the opportunity to understand, calculus in a way that I didn't understand it in high school, and nothing that any of the people who were teaching me this type of math could have said to me would have ever gotten me to that spot. And I realize this now looking backwards, like, oh, if you had explained it this way, I would have gotten it at the time. But the real problem was that you were incapable of describing it in any way other than the way that you personally understood it, which doesn't make you a very good teacher.
Yeah. And this is the argument for the, I can't remember what it's called. It's like the core.
Common core.
Common core. Yeah.
Common core math made a lot of sense to me the way that they teach it.
Yeah.
Conversely, like in contrast to the way that I was taught math, which how do they like, algorithmic math or something? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Like the way we were taught math is the way that if you can learn it, it can be very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, but it's not good for intuitive understanding of mathematics.
Right. The way that I was taught math sufficed to teach me a lot of like pathways to end cases and not anything about the theory of how I was trying to conceptualize the abstract concepts at work in mathematics.
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, okay. Well, I don't know how I can memorize this if it's meaningless to me. Like, it's just a bunch of gobbledygook. Anyway, you have to go to work. I'm going to hang up now.
Yep. Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
All right. I'm going to hit stop.
Great job, everybody.
Okay. Everybody. Bye.
All right.